The phenomenon of sleep has always been of great psychological importance to the human being. We know that the faculties and perceptions of man gradually developed over a long period of time and were conditioned largely by those environmental circumstances with which he was anciently familiar. We know definitely that the total impact of the visible world upon man has conditioned him and resulted largely in the specialization of his way of life as we know it. He observed water, air, clouds. He felt the impact of light and darkness, and he was constantly in contact with the forces of life moving around him in the other kingdoms of nature. He became keenly conscious of the growing seed, of the tree, of the habits of animals and of birds. And by degrees, all of these different environmental factors moved in upon his own internal receptivity, leaving marks and tracings in the subtle substances of his subconscious. During these periods, man was largely a receptive creature. He had very little available internal resource. He was unaware of himself as a factor capable of dominating nature, and the experiences around him did not immediately induce him to an aggressive attitude. Everything which he contacted, everything which impressed itself upon him, seemed to have a life and way of his own, of its own. It did not need him. But gradually he became aware that he required its help for his own survival. It never occurred to him to chain the clouds or to stop the course of water. His inventiveness was not yet born, and he wandered about in a world that seemed complete without him. He also recognized the basic needs of his kind for food, shelter, and these rudimentary necessities. He became more and more conscious of dependence, and this dependency did not result in an aggressive attitude. It was only after more faculty development and the release of more resource from within his own nature that he began to survey the world in terms of conquest. In these early times, therefore, he had what we would term today a psychic sensitivity. He had a keenness of perception, as yet unconditioned by reflection. This growth of reflective faculties and powers led to interpretation of nature, but observation led only to the acceptance of natural things. And in the course of these acceptances, he became increasingly aware of the two principal states of himself, waking and sleeping. Sleep was for him, at one time, an almost detached phenomenon. He considered sleep as a thing of itself. It came upon him. It was not part of his own nature, but was induced by the ways of life around him. The principal factor, probably, in environment was night. For before the development of fire, man was helpless in the darkness. It might be true that he had keener sight perception than he has today, but he could not compete with the visual skill of animals and birds. Therefore, with the coming of darkness, he came to a period of inaction, a period in which he could only wait. And in this period of inaction, the darkness around him crept in upon him, and he found himself entering a kind of internal darkness. He found consciousness slipping away from him, and he joined all the rest of nature in a period of repose. He probably had no concept that sleep was necessary. It was rather inevitable, for man was surrounded by inevitables. And about these, he contemplated as best he could, which was not very effectively. Gradually, however, as his life became more involved and complex, and fire gave him a certain victory in darkness, it became more and more obvious that sleep was a mechanism which he could not control, and for the lack of which he suffered unhappy consequences. Also, throughout all this procedure, man in a primitive way had experienced sleep phenomena. We know that animals experience it. Years ago, I used to keep dogs, and I have watched a dog asleep. His feet were moving as rapidly as possible. His entire nature, though unconscious, was alert, and there was no question in the world that he was romping somewhere. And a certain physical reaction was obvious in his body, as it is in the bodies of sleeping human beings. Thus, animals certainly do have internal phenomena. But in man, with a larger group of faculties, this is more evident and pronounced. After all, what we would term integration must result from a certain victory over unknowns. A man of old time did not have this victory. He did not, therefore, have this integration, this ability to bring reasonable and logical forces to play upon his activities. Thus, in sleep, with its phenomena, he was not certain that he was really merely resting. He became increasingly convinced that the gateway of sleep led into another world, a world with its own activities, a world that transcended the dimensions and boundaries of material existence. His sleep was variously animated with dreams and other similar occurrences. And in these dreams, time and place, relationships, and all the familiar situations of life were exaggerated, distorted, or changed. Perhaps one of his earliest experiences was this strange extra-dimensional quality of sleep, both regarding place and time. Thus, in his sleep, he could mingle with his dead ancestors. In sleep, he could meet and appear to know beings which he found no equivalent for in his outer or objective waking state. Thus, sleep affected him religiously and psychologically. It introduced him to the concept of ghosts. It gave him the belief that while his body rested, some part of himself departed therefrom and roamed in a region with different dimensions and relationships. Even modern man experiences visions which he regards as legitimate experiences. And many modern persons have firmly believed that during sleep they have a kind of separate existence. It is hard for them to deny this in the presence of the various things that occur during the sleeping processes. Today we regard sleep largely as an internal phenomenon, assuming that it is enriched with the psychological patterns which have already been impressed within our natures. We also find sleep symbolism susceptible of analysis and diagnosis, and gradually we have tied it closely to the pressures by which man is afflicted or with which he afflicts himself. Gradually, however, out of this broad generality, there came several also rather broad schools of thought. And we may say that sleep as symbolism, entirely apart from dreams or visions or things of that nature, that sleep has contributed several major concepts to the growth of man. In philosophy, for example, the question of sleep has brought with it several other questions relating to the fact of human consciousness. The Greeks, following somewhat the Platonic philosophy, and this in turn was rooted in older systems of Grecian learning, began to question the relationships of waking and sleeping. Because sleep life was much more vital, but much more mutable, changeable, and also in many ways represented, symbolically at least, processes not available in waking, such as teleportation, or the motion of the body from place to place, the ability to fly, to explore distant lands, to meet ancient and sacred people, to experience rituals and rites. All of these things occurring in sleep led the Greeks to ponder this simple question: what is man's natural consciousness? Is he actually awake while he is awake? Or does he really actually wake out of his so-called waking state through the mystery of sleep? In other words, is sleep a real awakening? Is man asleep in this world? Is his objective existence a kind of dream from which he is rescued by the mystery of sleep? Is he actually a citizen of this world or of his sleep world? By degrees, this philosophical problem became subjected to moral and cultural interpretations. One of these assumed, of course, that sleep represented a deficiency of consciousness, and another system that sleep represented a release or enlargement of consciousness. Most objectively, to primitive man at least, sleep represented a negative state. Therefore, to the philosopher, sleep could well be compared to ignorance. Ignorance was a sleeping of the mind, or its failure to awaken. And those creatures in whom the faculties of cognition, of reflection, were dim or undeveloped, were said to be asleep though awake. Now, we all realize that we use the term sleep symbolically in a number of instances. We refer to the individual as sleeping through experiences or failing to awaken to the urgency of causes. Indifference, therefore, suggests a lack of internal activity, whereas interest indicates an activity from within the person. In the old religious rites and systems, therefore, in ritualism and symbolism, man was said to possess another waking-sleeping polarity, which might function during his so-called conscious or awaking hours. Thus the wise, or those in whom the internal life was strong, were regarded as having a kind of wakefulness, whereas the unwise, or those unlearned and unskilled, were said to be sleeping. The term soul was introduced into this concept, and it was assumed that souls slept in bodies until, through disciplines or through the integration of themselves, their powers were released. The sleeping soul has become a familiar symbol in fairy stories, as in the case of Sleeping Beauty, or the ancient Nordic rite of Brunhilde, sleeping in the ring of flames cast around her by Wotan. Thus, The sleeping self was presumed to dwell in the body. The revelation or intensification of internal powers brought man to a state of waking. If, therefore, through indolence or through any failure to live to the fullest of his capacities and to continually increase these capacities, where such impulses were lacking, the person was said to be philosophically or spiritually asleep. This was one view in which sleep was regarded as inactivity. Now, there was a parallel concept that developed with it also. Namely, that because most men and most mortals living in this world are asleep to realities, this world is actually the place of deepest sleep. Those who are born are therefore declared to fall asleep in the process of birth, from which they awaken gradually during the procedures of growth and unfoldment. Wherever man is unable to remember, as in the dawn of his own physical existence, he is assumed to be emerging from a kind of sleep. Sleep also represented to ancient man the suspension of action, and as a rhythmic procedure was strengthened by his concepts of a polarized universe. Thus sleep came to be a kind of alternation, an inbreathing of life, and life passing into sleep retired into itself, finding its own root and uniting with it. Life awakening came forth out of itself into objectivity. Thus, an ancient concept, namely that waking is objective existence, sleeping subjective existence. This subjective-objective polarization was strengthened by man's observation of nature. He found winter and summer. He observed how in temperate zones trees and plants seem to die, how the tree casts its leaves and appears to be merely the skeletal remain of itself. Its energies disappear or retire deep into the earth and into the roots, and there it remains in a state of hibernation until the return of the sun god. By this concept, then, all life passed through these periods of objective and subjective polarization. A man going to sleep and awaking was moving upon a rhythm with universal significance. This rhythm, bound to the cycle of light and darkness, seemed to imply that it was normal and proper that man should have this twofold kind of existence, an existence obvious and of which he was conscious, and an existence less obvious of which he was not conscious. All these elements gradually resulted in philosophical implications going still further. And we find in the rise of Christian thinking that St. Paul refers to sleep as a kind of death, and that those who sleep retire into a miniature after-death state. This was also the belief of the Egyptians, who assumed that sleep was a little dying and death a great sleeping. Thus, this polarization became associated with life and death as basic factors in man's pattern of environmental circumstances. To be alive, then, was to be objective. To be asleep was to be subjective. Now, objectivity became increasingly of important to man because he gradually filled his outer life with activities. And in the course of the unfoldment of his arts and sciences and crafts and trades and beliefs and opinions, and in the simple enjoyments of whatever merits he had earned, man found sleep constantly interposing itself, so that as he became more active, it became an interruption to him. It meant that every day he must cease in the midst of some work and rest, and that the next day he must continue this labor. To a degree, then, sleep contributed to his concept of immortality, and probably was responsible for his earliest convictions about rebirth, because he made an important observation based upon nature around him, namely that things could appear to die and not really die. He observed in the difference between sleep and death in human bodies. He found that the body of the sleeping man had little more activity or sensory action than the dead body. But there was still a circulation in it, a warmth. He could determine the difference between sleep and death. And he therefore came to the conclusion that perhaps death itself, like the apparent death of the tree, was only of an appearance rather than of a fact. When he examined the dead tree, or the dead appearing tree in winter, he found little trace of life, because he would not know how to examine deeply enough to learn the truth. To him, the tree in winter was a corpse, cold, inanimate, and without sign of life. Yet even this corpse was revived. He also realized that the earth became sterile at certain seasons, that plants did not grow, that life did not come forth. But out of this barrenness, at the touch of spring, life came, and man recognized the resurrection of the dead. He became aware that with the light of the vernal equinox came forth life, drawn by the great light of the sun. Therefore, this season he set aside. We call it Easter. But to him it was the symbol of the restoration of life, the rebirth of things from darkness and from death. And in this visible circumstance, he rested his own hope of an immortal existence. So waking and sleeping became associated with theology and led him to some of the noblest speculations of man relating to his own destiny, his own origin, and his own immortality. Western man, continuing, however, to build a tremendous objective civilization, creating a greater and greater world around him, did not correspondingly enlarge the world within him. He did not attempt the cultivation of this unknown darkness, which he calls sleep. Factually, he has not done so even to this time. And we are still confronted with this sleeping phenomenon as a kind of interruption, a suspension of action, now regarded as necessary, but perhaps not as factually important as we have come to believe. Because after all, believing creates habits. Habits create phenomena. And the sleeping problem of man may be considerably more a habit than we know. But this habit has been so firmly set by millions of years that it will not easily be changed or altered. And any alteration will be accompanied by marked disturbances in the patterns of human life. This searching, therefore, for the value in sleep led Western man further to the conclusion that sleep was a process of recuperation. He found that gradually during the course of the day he became weary. His energies became exhausted. And as a result of exhaustion, a toxic condition arose within himself, which gradually obscured his objective consciousness and forced him into a recuperative condition. By this recuperative procedure, he was re-energized or revitalized, and he began to ponder why this was true and what larger implications he could derive from it. This led him to another discovery. Namely, that in some way, recuperation is associated with quietude. That a man may sleep, which is the most complete example of quietude which he knows, but he may also come into a semi-sleeping state in which his faculties are still active, but he is at the same time assuming a receptive attitude towards the recuperative forces of nature around him. We term this relaxation. Man discovered that relaxation, like sleep, rested him. And he also gradually learned to know that relaxation could, to a measure, substitute for sleep. Not completely, but to a degree that gave him greater possibility of longer function without unconsciousness. By degrees, then, relaxation unfolded its mystery in his experience, and he recognized quietude as very important. To attain quietude, he had to rest certain faculties and parts of himself. But he could rest these by his own decision rather than by the inevitable processes of nature. He could resolve to rest. He could set up mechanisms for relaxation. He could also learn to diversify activity so that some parts of him rested while others labored. He discovered that rest was really a letting down of tensions, and that intensity is a constant drain upon vitality. He further observed that as his objective life became more arduous and complicated, his activities more numerous, his ambitions stronger, his cravings more pronounced, that sleep as he knew it was no longer completely sufficient to him. One of the reasons for this, undoubtedly, whether he recognized it or not, was the intrusion of his living state upon his sleep state. It is quite possible that primitive man, because he had very little objective integration, was not as disturbed in his sleep as the man of today. Now, the fact that we may or may not remember disturbance does not necessarily mean that it does not exist. And we have today an increasingly important body of evidence to indicate that the individual does not always rest while sleeping. He may awaken in the morning, to use a current phrase, as tired as when he went to bed. He discovers that rest does not cause him to awaken refreshed and ready for the day. Instead of bouncing from his couch of sleep full of activity, he crawls forth and staggers into the kitchen for that cup of coffee which will actually give him the momentum for activity. Sometimes this may be due to shortening the hours of sleep by, again, the encroachment of activity upon his rest requirements. He may be up too late. He may be up too early. In any case, he does not experience the completeness of sleep. In all probabilities, however, the irregularity of his hours is not the primary factor. For most persons do the greater part of their sleep resting in the first 4 hours in which they are asleep. From the fourth to fifth hour onward, sleep is less deep, and the consciousness is drifting inevitably back toward the waking state, so that he accomplishes more in the early hours of sleep in terms of total rest than in the later hours. In any event, however, he awakens and finds that he is not rested. In some way, his objective existence has become so pressureful that sleep will not compensate for it. As a result, he must begin to reorganize his waking state, aiming at a conservation of resources, and particularly striving to prevent the rapid increase of toxin which sleep must overcome or neutralize. To do this, he has developed arts and sciences suitable to give a measure of rest and repose during waking hours. Where these are proper and normal, they certainly contribute to his well-being. But if he must have recourse to artificial sedation in order to achieve sleep, it means that the encroachment of waking activity is too great. Now, this encroachment may result in two consequences. One, difficulty in sleeping. And the second, disturbance during sleep. The individual whose mind is too active, which means too objectively focused upon occurrences, may have difficulty in achieving the condition necessary to sleep. Nature, of course, is rather wise in its workings and almost inevitable in its procedures. Therefore, when exhaustion becomes acute, man has to sleep. And there are very few persons who have actually died from lack of sleep, unless they were under some artificial pattern of extreme stimulation. Nature will demand that rest which it absolutely requires. But where the patterns are not well integrated, the individual does not have the same sense of well-being which comes from rationalization of procedure. Actually, man has to achieve polarization of activity constantly in order to remain well. Therefore, his waking hours, which occupy some two-thirds of his time, must also be divisible into periods of activity and repose. The human being, because of mental activity, does not find it easy to repose by doing nothing. The process of merely sitting down and trying to rest is boring and nerve-wracking to the average individual. Therefore, he seeks repose by reducing tension and selecting activities which do not appear arduous to him. Thus, he finds entertainment, relaxation, sports, all kinds of things which are themselves still activities contributing to rest, largely because they temporarily disassociate his mind from intensive programs of survival. The rising tide of economics and the pressures resulting therefrom has caused a great deal of tension in man. And the generation in which we live, with its very highly competitive approach to living, causes more fatigue than the individual can commonly compensate for by sleep as he knows it. Thus, a whole group of remedial agencies have been introduced to give man rest while he is awake. Not only rest, perhaps, but to copy, insofar as is possible, the very recuperative processes of sleep. Thus, through specialized consideration of nutrition, through the use of vitamins, through the development of certain attitudes toward life, man attempts to compensate for overactivity in certain brackets or branches of his daily living. Philosophy, of course, and religion have taken the attitude that attitude itself can be either a cause of rest or a cause of pressure. Faith, for example, is a magnificent relaxing power. Fear, on the other hand, is a source of tension and causes an unreasonable exhaustion of resources. Man has also learned that there are two distinct ways of becoming tired. One is by physical activity, and the other is by mental activity. Mental activity, becoming increasingly important as the human faculty structure increases in power and intensity, mental activity, if constructive, produces less tension than if it is destructive. An individual can think happy thoughts for a long time without noticeable or appreciable fatigue. But a few moments of unhappy thoughts will bring, as a result, a distinct sense of depletion. And out of these things, a kind of morality has developed, an ethics based upon experience. Man has learned that bad mental, emotional, and physical habits produce exhaustion. Exhaustion in itself interferes with function. The exhausted person is unable to carry the responsibilities of life with dignity. The only answer seems to be that the person must overcome the false causes of exhaustion in himself. If, therefore, he is resolved to achieve a sense of well-being, which might result from a normal relationship between sleeping and waking, he must now make certain conscious cooperations with natural procedure. He must attempt to cultivate repose and to escape from all such pressures as are contrary to repose. Ambitions, for example, may be most gratifying, and the individual may become hopelessly addicted to them, but they're exhausting. And wherever ambition or any other activity becomes overly dominant, where it becomes obsessive or possessive, it results in continuous patterns of energy expenditure. And these patterns end in not only depletion, but open the system to disease. Thus, out of his need for rest, man has discovered some of his most valuable secrets about health. For health is associated with normal rhythms of action and rest, not only allowing for waking and sleeping, but for innumerable small cycles developing in minutes and in hours, whereby for each expenditure of energy, we must have a corresponding increase of energy reserve. If we fail to do so, we are in trouble. Further, as we go along, man has observed that certain functions of his mind, certain habits and patterns of his emotions, have a tendency to cooperate with recuperative procedure. He finds that idealism helps him to moderate extremes of action. Philosophy gives him a certain release from ambition, from possession, from fear, grief, and anxiety. He observes, therefore, that philosophy is, as the Greeks described it, a medicine for the soul. From these simple beginnings, then, of waking and sleeping, man has gradually unfolded a series of projections of thinking, which have influenced and to a large degree regulated his conduct. Not because he wished to be obedient, but because he could not afford the consequences of disobedience. Because by degrees he realized that he must obey in order to function, in order to have an adequate and purposeful existence. In religious systems, mysticism is a kind of waking sleeping. To the mystic, life becomes an exceedingly quiet, orderly communion with his own internal powers. He is therefore capable of completely relaxing, and many of his faculties become somnolent in this procedure. His ambitions retire or relax. His attachments to worldliness, with the attendant pressures and responsibilities of achievement, these bonds are loosened, and he attains a strange transcendent quietude. The ancient found this in his trance, and he believed that he could create within himself a kind of suspension of activity by means of which his entire objective life was held in abeyance, was not permitted to take over with its tremendous rhythms and powerful pressure incentives. In the experimenting with this factor, he made another discovery, namely that through quietude, objective quietude, a kind of artificial sleep induced by reason, that he became suddenly more aware of his internal life. He found that his focal point moved from environment to self. He also realized that the direction of his energies flowed now toward an internal life rather than toward an external career. Thus, we begin to see a differentiation between extroversion and introversion, the waking state being the natural polarization of extroversion, the sleeping state the overall symbolic pattern of introversion. The individual retiring into himself appeared inanimate to others, but became increasingly animate to himself, as in the case of yoga or the Eastern disciplines, in which the reduction of objective activity results in the release of a tremendous internal activity, which, however, does not appear to have any direct fatiguing effect upon the body. Thus, by the suspension of the bodily functions, man became increasingly aware of an internal existence. He then began to draw away what he considered a curtain between waking and sleeping. And he discovered that the internal, introversional world of himself could be more real and more powerful than his external environment. Here he was placed, of course, in a dilemma, because he learned also from experience the danger of a total introversion. He began to recognize the possibility of escaping from reality, as he objectively knew it, into something imponderable, the validity of which he had not demonstrated. He wondered, therefore, whether his escape through subjectivity was an illusion, whether he was passing from fact to fancy, whether his inner life was merely a kind of half-waking dreaming, or whether perhaps he was approaching the reality of himself. Man had a certain ego from the beginning, and by this ego he liked to think that he was different, that he had a peculiar nature of his own, and that in some mysterious way he was greater than he seemed to be. This greatness was not obvious, perhaps, in his relationship with others, but he could cultivate it in an imaginary life within himself. We know in psychology that a very primitive atavistic instinct throws man into himself in emergency, creating introversion. This introversion becomes associated with less and less centralization in matter. The individual is aloof, separate, and apart. He may also gradually develop monastic inclinations, turn to the life of the hermit, and even though he remains in society, build all his values upon intangibles. This, of course, made it important to estimate the strength of these intangibles, whether this internal life could be depended upon. In those days, he was no psychologist. And he was not aware of how the inner life is molded by environment and other factors of external existence.